and welcome to another edition of the Insiders Podcast. My name is Tevye Morrow. I'm an editor and reporter at The Spectator. And this week, my guest is sports columnist Steve Milton. Steve's weekend feature is called Our Father's Game, which examines Canada's long relationship with lacrosse. Steve's feature dovetails with the 150th anniversary of the Canadian Lacrosse Association. But of course, lacrosse was played by Indigenous peoples long before Confederation. Maybe you can tell us a little bit about that, Steve.
Because it's not recorded history, Tevye, it's hard to say where it started. It was one of those games that sort of generated. As people on Six Nations tell me, responsible for the sort of oral history and the written history of this game, most Indigenous peoples, most First Nations had some kind of stick and ball game. But for sure, it was played as early as the middle of the 17th century, and it was in full swing then. So it had to be played at least 100 years here in Canada and the northern United States, all around the Great Lakes, probably a century before that. And it was all based, it's called the Creator's Game, and it was based, most of the people who played it were of the Iroquois Confederacy or Algonquins. And that's where the heart of the game has always been in First Nations, although other First Nations have now started to play more of the game, changed their own stick and ball games to lacrosse over time.
How did the Europeans come to know lacrosse? How did that happen?
Well, the first probably recorded reference of it was by Jean de Brebeuf, a Jesuit missionary, and it was actually in stateside, somewhere in Michigan, I think Michilimackinac or something like that. And he had noticed them playing it. It might have been even in Wisconsin, because there's a town there called La Crosse in Wisconsin. It was two words, La Crosse. Why it was named that, there are several theories, but one is that the sticks may have reminded Catholic missionaries of the crooks that were carried by missionaries at that time. And there were a couple of other theories on that, but that's probably the one that's most accepted. And he saw the game being played and described it in words and written down. The game then was played for a number of different reasons, but one of the things that it didn't have was a set field. It could be different at every game, and was often, they could be 10 or 20 a side. Now it's 5 or 6 a side, and sometimes in field lacrosse I think 11. But it could be as many as 100 on each different team, and it could be a violent game. It in various First Nations languages, it's referred to as the Creator's Game, or the Little Brother to War, or a substitute for war, or a healing game. And often they were called to the game by medicine men, and so there it was a medicine game for your health and for your spirituality, your spiritual health. It is also related greatly to what in some languages, Mohawk would be one, that the Creator's Game is played all the time in the sky world. In other words, there's a constant game being played all the time. In other First Nations, animals play the game in what we would call heaven. So there's a real spiritual base to this. And maybe I can say something about that spiritual base. And that's the hickory, which is the best stick the best wood to make a stick, and there's lots of hickory out on Six Nations, and quite often the stick makers out there will be driving down the road and they'll see what they call shag bark hickory. It's a kind of the bark is just basically shaggy, and they'll make the sticks out of that because it's easy to form, but it's strong. It doesn't break. It doesn't dry out as easily as some other sticks. The feeling in many Indigenous peoples' minds was that it was a connection between the Creator and the live human beings through the stick, because it comes from the earth.
Wow, right? Interesting.
Yeah, it's a very spiritual thing.
So it's a different sort of much deeper sense of religiosity when we talk about lacrosse being hockey being a religion versus lacrosse being a religion. There's a very different.
I address that, and I hope not too cynically, because I'm a hockey guy. Soccer is considered a religion around the world, but they aren't, because it doesn't have a spiritual base. It has something in it that makes people go crazy. But I would call that, and I do in the story, secular fanaticism. because it isn't particularly religious or spiritually based. We just alter what we consider spiritual and what we consider religion to fit that.
Right.
So, right. Or some way of explaining the unexplainable, which is our love for the game.
You write about in your main feature about these two streams of lacrosse.
Right.
And in some ways, I think the way that I've read your feature, this split has some ugly origins. I mean,
yeah.
If I'm correct, you write by 1880. Indigenous teams were banned from playing in the national championship.
Yeah, and what happened in 1867, and I'm not going to denigrate this because this is the first national sports body in Canada was the Canadian Lacrosse Association. It started on Confederation Day. They had a couple of games, one here, one in Toronto, one in Montreal, and the one in Montreal they're celebrating again this weekend. But essentially, that was... I hate to be derogatory here, but that was the sort of start of white man's lacrosse, because a dentist named Dr. Beers in Montreal, and he should be celebrated because he took a game that looked to the settlers, to the Victorian. Remember, these are Victorian people now looking at this game and thinking, well, this is a bit undignified. This is a bit wild. This is a bit spontaneous. This is a little bit undefined, which to me sounds like a hell of a lot of fun. But that, so they codified the rules. They made it. They changed it more from a ball-carrying game to a ball-passing game over time, and then I think it was unavoidable. What they said that by 1880 they were saying that Native teams could not play, First Nations teams could not play what were essentially white teams, because everybody then was white who wasn't Native. That nobody could. Those teams couldn't play because they were professionals. I don't know where they got that, who was paying the professionals, but really, translated, that meant too good, in my mind. Also, it fit into the marginalization and the exclusionism that was our policy towards First Nations, and we know that now.
In
all aspects of society, and this was becoming a society game. Now, those First Nations had a number of had their own leagues, a lot of them, and many of them still exist today. There's two or three of them that still exist today, particularly the Can-Am game that one of the teams in Six Nations plays on, Can-Am League, and they play teams from upstate New York. But that's right, and so what happened then is it became the possession of basically white players, and then, of course, as Canada changed, it wasn't white anymore. There were other ethnicities playing. Ethnicities, is that the word?
Sure, yeah.
Playing. But it went through huge peaks and valleys, and this is a roundabout way of getting to your question about the two streams. So we've already shown what the one stream of spirituality was, which came from the earth. This is the creator's game. It's my theory that in the game of lacrosse, which has risen like a phoenix several times to have pro leagues, but every time there was a pro league, I think the first one was 1901, and then there was another one in 1918, another one in 1931, another one in a very short-lived one in 1968, a really good one in the middle of the 1970s, but it folded for a couple of reasons. After those, the game would retrench. And after both World Wars, the game would retrench. It lost its momentum. And by then, it had become what they call box lacrosse. In 1931, that pro league, because the NHL owners needed something to put in their arenas to make money in the summertime. So three of them got together, formed the lacrosse league, and added Cornwall to it. Billy Isaacs from here, who was playing here at the time, but was really a Six Nations Mohawk, was the first true star of that. People like Lionel Conacher played in that league. But every time it would retrench afterwards, but it would retrench to what are basically hard scrabble, particularly in Ontario, but even in BC, some of the suburbs around Vancouver, what are now suburbs but were individual towns then. But in Ontario, you're looking at places like Peterborough, Owen Sound to a degree, certainly when Orangeville in latter years, Oshawa for sure, Toronto's Lakeshore, and we're talking Mimico, New Toronto, and as far as out Clarkson at that point, and St. Catharines, places like that, Fergus, all of which are kind of blue-collar towns. It was a cheap sport. It was played by blue-collar players an awful lot, and it was a family sport. If you look, there were all kinds of brothers playing in the game, and their fathers played. And it was in those places that the game stayed alive until the next Pro League came along, which happily came in 1998-99 here with the Toronto Rock. It started in Hamilton, the Toronto Rock, and that's been sustained. That's been almost 20 years now. So there hasn't been quite the valley that we've seen. But in those valleys that sometimes became trenches, those towns and the people in those towns and two and three generations kept it alive. They kept the flame alive for a game they do. And when I quote a guy from one of those towns, Peterborough, saying, "We all fell in love with the stick." There is a spirituality to that. The idea you had to keep it alive and the honoring of your forefathers who played the game. Because now it's your dad and your grandfather who also played in Peterborough, who also played in Oshawa. So that's why I call them parallel streams of spirituality.
Right. What in one of your stories that I've just read, you mentioned something that I'm going to call the Blue Jays effect.
Yeah.
And can you explain what is your source talking about when he says that?
Well, and he's talking about lacrosse, but it happened to a couple of other sports too, primarily fast pitch softball as well. People that were playing the game switched over to basically what we used to call hardball because of the Jays, because of their successes. So it happened sort of in the late 70s at the same time a Pro League had folded, so we get that period of retrenchment again, combined with the Blue Jays arriving. Then when they got really successful in the last two or three years, people imitate success, right? And they imitate success that's nearby. And the Blue Jays are nearby to all of us because of television, and in our case in Hamilton, geographical proximity. So younger players, boys and girls, gravitate towards that sport. So the feeling is that some baseball players have left. It's a summer sport, so you're choosing between those two. Soccer is another one that dragged some people away from lacrosse because it's played outdoors. One of lacrosse's biggest problems at the younger level, and it really, really hurt it in the 60s and early 70s because of the coming of cottages and air-conditioned homes and those kinds of things, is it's played in rinks, most of them smaller rinks with low ceilings, slippery floors, boiling, right? So a lot, you know, no air conditioning. Right, and they weren't meant to have open ends, so there wasn't a lot of air blowing through there, even if you opened all the doors, which you do. So if you'd walk by a lacrosse game, a minor lacrosse games, you'd see at halftime the guys outside the rink. I mean, I spent a lot of time in Huntsville, which is a very strong lacrosse place, and in between periods, you'd see that all the guys or girls playing flattened out, almost dying on the at between periods, just trying to get some fresh air.
So this is a logistical problem.
Part of it is a logistical problem.
Right.
It was also a problem with the pro leagues because when they came indoors, and most of those leagues weren't air conditioned most of those arenas weren't air conditioned until 15, 20 years ago. The National Lacrosse League comes along, run by Americans who often come into our country and show us how to do things right. And they really did in lacrosse. And they said, "What are you idiots playing in the summer for?" Because that's when your biggest market, in other words, young players, are also playing. They can't come to the games. So put your pro league in the wintertime.
I see.
And now that made some logistical problems because now you had to be able to cover the ice on the thing, but it worked.
Right.
I mean, they're drawing. I don't know if you saw this, but in last week's National Lacrosse League final, won by a team from the South, they were located in the South, mostly Canadian players on it, the Georgia Swarm. The final game was in Saskatoon. They drew 14,600 people.
Wow.
And they've been drawing that most of the year. Right. Colorado, it's very big. So this league has some, it's about to expand again too with NHL and NBA ownership, another three or four teams, and that'll really stabilize. When you have something like that to aim to, just as we said about baseball, then kids will play it. If we ever get a pro team back here, more players would play in Hamilton.
One of the things that I remember, I grew up in BC,
right,
on Vancouver Island, and it was kind of the thing to do.
It really
if you
was.
Played hockey.
Yeah.
In the off season, all the kids, they played lacrosse. That's what they did. But I read in your story that has changed. And what is that attributed to?
It's attributed to the same thing that's affected a lot of other sports. But hockey was the first one in this country to do it, which is the year round, mostly meaning summer hockey. Wayne Gretzky was always big on this. Play 1 week of summer hockey. The rest of the time, play baseball. Or he suggested lacrosse because it was better for your hockey skills. It was better for your hand-eye, better for deflections, because the ball comes off, as I mentioned earlier, the board so quickly. You got to have really good hand-eyes, excellent for deflection in front of the net. So you had players like Joey Nieuwendyk, who won a national junior championship, the Minto Cup, we call that, for Whitby in 1984. One of his teammates, of course, was his longtime teammate in hockey, too, Gary Roberts. Those guys played. All kinds of players played. They either played fast pitch. All of those players in the 40s and 50s in the NHL, 60s, some of the great names, that you name them, they almost every one of them played another sport. And it was either fast pitch or lacrosse, depending where you grew up. If you grew up in the prairies, you weren't playing lacrosse, right, because they didn't have much lacrosse there. The pockets were the lower BC mainland, Vancouver Island, and Ontario.
I want to get back to Six Nations again.
Right.
You knew a Six Nations lacrosse great, Gaylord Pavlis.
Yeah.
Can you talk about him?
Gaylord, yeah, he taught me a lot about the game. He taught me something, and I don't want to say that much. I mean, I don't know how much he taught me about First Nations, and made me feel at home out there. Gaylord was a longtime friend. He died young. He led the Oshawa Green Gales. They won 7 straight Minto Cups. They were legends. One of the greatest teams in any sport in the history of this, not this game, of any sport in Canada. He played on about 5 of those, and he was legendary for what he could do with his stick. His father was great, too. Gaylord was inducted into the Hall of Fame this year. We just announced it's Canada's Hall of Fame. There are only 8 lacrosse players out of 629 players, and some guys played, like a Lionel Conacher, played both. But Gaylord brought the game back to sort of prominence. We knew he was as famous in Oshawa as Bobby Orr was. He was as well known at that time as Bobby Orr was. So that tells you what kind of status he had, and it kind of gave it his presence triggered the next pro league, which happened in 1968, about the time that he was about ready to come out of junior. So he is one of those guys that the Oswegan Arena, which is for both hockey and lacrosse, is now called the Gaylord Pavlis Arena. His family's really, really well known, and there's other lacrosse players besides Gaylord with the last name of Pavlis. And there are now, I should mention this, when you mentioned Six Nations, they have the only, for lacrosse only, arena that I know of in the world. It's called the ILA, the Iroquois Lacrosse Arena. So they have the Gaylord Pavlis Arena where they can play, and they have the ILA, and there are 6 or 7 teams playing out there. At one point, Kevin Sandy, who runs lacrosse out there, and is also head of what they call the Iroquois, it's called Iroquois Lacrosse, which is a private company that goes around Canada, and sometimes to reserves, First Nations, where they don't have the game, to proselytize the sport, to talk about the history of it, show why you should play it, what's great about it, that kind of thing, to talk about the wooden sticks, the history of it, how far back it goes. It's by far Canada's oldest sport. It's also Canada's most oldest organized sport.
Right.
So he said that when he was growing up, they all had to play the game out in Hagersville, and then some mums and dads got together and got the Oswegan Arena built. Well, go from that, where they had to go outside of the... Now there are several First Nation-owned senior teams. 2 in the Pro League are First Nation owned, or owned by people either by a First Nation or somebody who is an Indigenous person. That's Rochester is the one, and the other one is the Massachusetts Black Wolves, which are owned by the Mohican tribe, they call it. They call themselves the Mohican tribe. So flashback, finally the junior, they start having teams in the OLA, Ontario Lacrosse Association, that represent Six Nations. Now, lots of non-natives played on those teams, some people from Hamilton, but they were basically Indigenous people playing on those games, mostly Iroquois. And they won the 1992 Minto Cup, and the captain, it's quoted in this story, said at the time, "This is for all First Nations in Canada." It was the first major lacrosse trophy through the association that is celebrating its 150 this week, won by a reserve team. And it's got to the point that 3 years ago, in 2014, the 4 biggest divisions in lacrosse, what we call amateur lacrosse, but a lot of players get money under the table or travel money and those kinds of things. The same guys who play pro, this is what they do in the summertime. It's Senior A, Senior B, or Major A, Senior B, Junior A, Junior B. Six Nations won the Ontario Championship in all 4. And 3 of them went on to win the National Championship, and the other one finished 2nd. That's how far it's come. From no teams being allowed to play against non-native teams in 1880.
Now, given this history of discrimination, how important is this ownership in a literal and figurative sense for First Nations of the sport?
I don't want to speak for them. And I didn't get a hold of Kurt Stiers, who is the guy who owns the Rochester team in the Pro League. But players and people on Six Nations have told me it's extremely important. It's that year when they won all four, it was euphoria. Hmm. So, and I can't go much farther than that because I don't live there. I don't.
Sure.
Yeah, I haven't been part of it, but just going on second and third hand knowledge, it did an awful lot for them. And it's now the biggest minor lacrosse association in Canada, which makes it the biggest minor lacrosse association in the world. 4,000 kids playing on it.
Wow.
And a lot of that is partly because of revival of the love of the history of it, and people actually taking it in their own hands to promote that history. It's taught in school. I've heard variously from players out there that they learn a lot about the history of the game, the creator's game, grade 6 or grade 8. I did a feature on a stick maker out there named Bo Hinhock, and he's pretty rapturous when he talks about making the stick and what it means and taking it from the earth, something from the earth to make. And he has a special stick that he uses only for medicine games, which in medicine games are held once a year on Six Nations. And he says, again, that's where I heard the word Sky World from him. His stick will be waiting for him. That stick in the Sky World.
Wow. Well, you say you're a hockey guy, but you talk with a lot of passion.
I'm passionate about lacrosse, yeah. Because have you ever played catch with a lacrosse stick?
Yeah, sure.
It's like baseball in one way. You can play catch with yourself. If you have a lacrosse ball and you have a good stick, you just go to the schoolyard and bang, and you can do all the fancy things with it. You move it behind your head, throw the ball under your arms, you cradle it, you try to do this or that. I think it's difficult to master, and I haven't. But I'm buying a stick from Bo because I haven't had one in my hands to do this for a long, long time, and I'm probably getting to the age where I'm trying to relive some of the things I used to like to do. I never played the game, but I loved to play catch with it. My closest friend for many years was Gaylor Powell's best friend. That's the connection there.
I see.
And we used to play a lot, and he played pro, this friend of mine, and he showed me a few things, and he was one of the tough guys. Gaylord was a finesse guy, really finesse guy. I mean, if you ever watched him play, it was unbelievable. You could not follow the ball when you saw a great player play, whether he was Indigenous, like Gaylord, or a guy named Jack Bionda, who also played in the NHL, who was white and played in Huntsville. You could not follow the ball, because they could do so many fancy things with the stick.
So you just told me what you like about what you can do with the stick.
Yeah.
As a spectator, what do you love about lacrosse?
Fast. Really, really fast. It still has an element of violence to it. They're trying to tone that down. They're particularly trying to tone down the fighting, and I agree with that. They don't do as many cross-checks as they once did. The sticks used to be wood, and you really got hit hard. And many of the guys don't even wear the kidney pads anymore because they don't get cross-check like they used to. They've taken a lot of that out of the game. Some people say to the detriment of the game, but you aren't going to grow a game in which you can get your kidneys pounded by cross-check. So a cross-check off the ball used to be quite legal in lacrosse. In the early 60s, when I first started to follow the game, it was a very violent game and a low-scoring game. But they added the shot clock, and now there's offensive players and defensive players. They invented what they call a long bench, which means when the defensive players run off the field, they come in one door, but the offensive guys go out the other door, which is much closer to the goal.
I see.
And it's really fun to watch that. The Pro League, that's a huge part of the professional league. And I just love the fact that here's another thing about this game. It's three-dimensional. The shots come from everywhere. They come from the side. They come from the top. They bounce in front of the goalie, and they come up. So it really is, it's an angles game, a real angles game.
Right. Well, Steve Milton's feature, it's called Our Father's Game, and there's some web elements if you have the internet and that you can check out as well. It's been a fascinating talk. Thanks a lot for chatting.
Thanks, Debbie. Thanks for having me.
And thanks for tuning in for another edition of the Insiders Podcast Playlist. And we look forward to next week's edition. Thanks very much. Okay.